Hello and welcome to The World in 30 Minutes, the podcast on the events, policies and ideas that will shape the world for the European Council on Foreign Relations. My name is Mark Leonard and I'm talking to you live from the Munich Security Conference for our annual podcast from the capital of Bavaria, where many of the world's leaders descend for a few days of very sweaty and heated discussions about all of the big events that are shaping our world. And I have an all-star cast to help us make sense of this. First up, we have Arantxa Gonzalez, who is a board member and a council member of ECFR, but has also played a lot of important roles in Spanish politics as foreign minister, as well as being a really key figure on many of the multilateral economic questions which the world is facing, which form the backdrop to some of the geopolitical discussions that we're talking about. And also from ECFR, we have Jana Pulierin, the head of ECFR's Berlin office and a senior policy fellow at ECFR. And back to the podcast, once again, it's Camille Grand, who's a distinguished senior policy fellow at ECFR and heads up our defense initiative. So, Arantxa, you've been coming to MSCs for many years now. What are your main takeaways so far?
I mean, first, very well attended, which tells us that this conference has touched a raw nerve, which is a sense of insecurity that is faced across the world. Second, very diverse. This used to be the place where a happy few, mostly countries in the north, would meet to discuss defense and security. This year, we saw many other faces around the table. Third takeaway, there has been a good description of the problems. There's been a good description of the risks. There has been a good report explaining that if we do not manage the risks properly, it's going to end up in a lose-lose situation. But we were relatively short on answers. That's my takeaway.
Okay. What about you, Jana?
So honestly, I have the impression that I live in a parallel universe or in kind of several universes at the same time. When we discuss transatlantic relations, you have the official delegations with the talking points. Trump is never mentioned. And then you have the chatters in the corridors. Same on Ukraine. You have official talking points on Ukraine. A lot of, we're going to be there as long as it takes. But then also in our conversations, in closed door sessions or also in the corridors, there's a lot of worry and a lot of despair even. Then it is about, I don't know, two parallel versions of Europe. So officially Europe, the EU has done a lot and has had a little Zeitenwende and all that. And then the reality, I think, is much more sobering. So I have the impression that, it's kind of that we really have different conferences and different bubbles. And some of the discussions are not really about what people have on their minds.
Okay. We've got quite a few that we've seen some of the speeches. We're in the middle of the conference, so we haven't seen everything yet, but we should talk about some of the big things that have happened in the next couple of minutes. One of the most striking things was the way it started with the announcement of Navalny's death just as it was beginning, and this incredible scene of Navalny's wife coming and speaking to the conference goers a few hours after she discovered that her husband had died. It's a pretty raw way of starting, which brought the stakes in global politics very much to life for everyone who was attending it. Kemi, what were your big takeaways so far?
Obviously, the Navalny event and the what needs to be called the Navalny murder in many ways was a shock to every participant. And the fact that Yulia Navalny was in the room reacting in such a forceful and decent manner to what is an atrocious situation was very shocking to all of us. It was a sort of also bizarre way for Putin to reinvite himself at the Munich Security Conference, He had been a feature in the late 2000s. It is where he developed his speech in 2007 about his new vision for the European order. And we see what how he's been implementing it quite forcefully since. And it is interesting to see how our leaders and the leaders of the West are still reacting in a sort of disorder to this new order trying to be imposed on them, struggling to support Ukraine, struggling to meet the defense requirement, even, of course, if Europe has turned the corner. But that was, to me, one of the most impressive elements. The second thing I would add, which is more on the sort of side event type of atmospherics, is a comeback of some hard security conversation. Which is not the only side events that were taking place, but of course that's the ones I attended.
When you say hard, you mean very hard, like nuclear policy.
Nuclear policy issues associated with how do we do enablement of forces at NATO? How do we do really serious conversations on these matters on the sidelines, which show that we're in a different environment?
It's a war conference, not a peace conference.
In many ways.
So why don't we, I think one of the big themes here, you know, are the two big uninvited guests. I think you were describing them as that, Arantxa, earlier on, Putin, that we've already heard about, and Donald Trump's kind of looming over everything. And we're going to talk a lot about how that plays into it in the second half of the podcast. But before we do that, maybe we should go through some of the big speeches that we've heard, which obviously fit into that context. We've had the Vice President of the United States, Kamala Harris, who started out on the first day. Does anyone want to talk a bit about her?
I missed her completely, unfortunately.
Okay. Yeah, you need to tell that to Arantxa.
Yeah, but that shows how kind of crowded this conference is and how full of, I don't know, separate events.
No, I thought it was a message aimed at the American citizen. It wasn't so much a message for the Munich Security Conference crowd. It was rationalizing and explaining and doing pedagogy over why it matters that the U.S. remains engaged in international affairs, why it matters that it remains committed to the Transatlantic Alliance, and why it matters that it supports Ukraine in these very difficult moments. And it was, I thought, well crafted in order to convince the American citizen that this should be a priority for them, that isolationism, as she said, she used a very interesting sentence that I'm going to repeat because I thought it sums it up. Isolation is not insulation. And I think this is an important message that the American citizen needs to hear. More importantly, it's a message that America's Congress needs to hear. I think this is also part of the game. Them being here is being exposed to what we all want, we all think, we all hope they will do, which is to pass the package of support for Ukraine.
So on the sidelines, there's been a lot of American congressmen and women and senators all with quite a high level of despair, actually, about the war fatigue of the American people. I think, in a way, it's a self-selecting bunch. The ones that came here are the ones who want to support Ukraine.
No, but still, this the disconnect I referred to, when I listened to the American delegation here, Republicans and Democrats said, yeah, we will not kind of leave you alone. We'll still be engaged in Europe. And you heard a lot of talking points that they had a year ago as well, when Mitch McConnell said, don't listen to the fringes. We got you covered. And the reality has so much shifted now with this bill hanging kind of in the House, not being voted on. Nobody knows if the support for Ukraine will come. And so you have this sentiment, and also you have American participants telling you in bilats how worried they are. But on the public stage, all seems to be fine. And they say, we get it through Congress. And the phrase I've heard three times was kind of this Churchill quote, America does...
It does the right thing in the end after having exhausted all alternative options. Okay, very good. Another big speaker today was on Saturday was Zelensky, the president of Ukraine. What did you take away from his comments?
I think it was he opened on Navalny, and he had a very strong and powerful message on Navalny that I would stress. The second thing is he really turned to the supporters of Ukraine, and I think he was open and honest about that. And he phrased it by saying, don't ask when the war will end. Ask yourself why Putin is still able to continue it, which is a message to the Europeans and the Americans on the decline in assistance and in U.S. assistance and the debates over U.S. assistance that we were just discussing, but also to the Europeans on put your act together at pace. And I think that was a pretty powerful message. It is a slightly different Zelensky from previous MSCs, less of a superstar, but certainly someone who's passing very, not necessarily easy to hear messages to the Europeans, but really saying, and the Americans saying, it's up to you now. We've done our bit. We've resisted for 723 days. But if we want to
24 days.
We are in the 24th. and many thought we would resist only for one day or 1 week. So we've done our bit. We need you.
But the problem is that everybody in the audience basically knows that if we just continue like we did for the past 2 years, that will not be enough. I mean, we haven't been successful in putting Ukraine in a position to really put kind of significant pressure on Russia so that Russia would somehow come to the conclusion that this war doesn't make sense, and that even kind of to keep the current level of support will be difficult. But what we really would need is to do more. And that was also his message.
I think he was coming with a bit of good news, because the security agreements with Berlin and Paris had been signed in the previous 2 days, following the one with London. So there are some positive signs in terms of long-term commitments by big European players. Yet, what Yana said remains true, which is, allowing them to, if not prevail in the battlefield, at least be in a very clear position to impose costs on Russia, and sort of inverse the logic that strategic patience plays for Putin.
I also thought that maybe he was starting to change the narrative on what Ukrainian victory would look like. There was much less focus on recalling. I mean, he did mention taking territory back once, but it wasn't the kind of centerpiece of his story, which I think was much more about proving that Ukraine was a real country, that it's a democracy, that it can join the West, that it can be, that it has a European future, which is a different way of thinking about this. I think it would be good to talk a bit more about Europe, because we haven't mentioned Europe very much yet. But maybe before we do that, we should talk about China, which was one of the other stories today, with Wang Yi giving a speech. I think you and I saw that together. Yana, do you want to tell me what you
I don't
you
know what your impression was, but after I listened to that speech, I got the impression that China is the most benevolent country in the world, has brought peace to a lot of conflicts, has tried desperately to bring peace to Ukraine while not criticizing Russia at all in the entire speech. Instead highlighting that good relations with Russia are essential for China. I thought that was...
I thought there was some skepticism in the hall. He did say that... he said that China didn't start the war in Ukraine, and we're not contributing to it. We have a totally normal relationship with Russia, like any relationship. It's not an alliance. It's not aimed against any particular country. I don't know what country could be thinking about when he says it's not aimed at them, but it was an interesting.
China brought peace to Saudi Arabia and Iran, and brokered the talks. And so I really, China's the most benevolent country on earth and not a problem at all.
And that the economy is doing very well as well.
Yeah, gathered in the
audience. We had 5.2% growth last year, and the Chinese economy, it was a bit like a Davos speech, actually, in a strange way, rather than a Munich Security Conference speech. But actually, there's less China than one would have expected. People are kind of drawing China in. I've noticed quite a few Americans and NATO people kind of drawing China into the Ukraine story and talking about this sort of axis of China and Russia and North Korea and Iran and the drones and the missiles that come from these different places. But there's a lot less China this year than there was
in 2020. It was all about China. I still remember this. And so compared to where we've been in that debate, yeah, you're right.
So anyway, we should talk a bit about Europe now, both in the kind of Ukraine setting, but also in the Trump, Trump uncertainty, I think is probably the best way of describing it.
But before we go to the Trump uncertainty, can I just mention that I think it's a big shame that Macron isn't here and that Donald Tusk isn't here and that there are heads of state and government from Europe. Kaya Kallas is here, Mark Rutte. But when you talk about the European presence at this conference, I think what I'm missing is the strong signal, a united European signal of kind of coordinated speeches, Europeans walking in the same direction. I don't see that really.
Well, I don't know. What I find is that partly because the intergovernmental bits in Europe have been so difficult, it's created a vacuum which Ursula von der Leyen and the European Commission have filled. And she was filling it today. It's quite unusual, actually. If you look at the history of European security, of Munich security conferences, it's pretty rare for the European Commission to be leading the charge for building a geopolitical thing.
But it tells you a lot about the state of Europe if the president of the European Commission is basically the one that the last woman standing for.
But there were lots of women. There was Mette Frederiksen. There was.
I don't agree with this. I mean, I think it's a signal that maybe we are moving in a more federal direction as regards a more federal concept of security and defense. That, frankly, would not be such a bad deal.
I hope you're right.
Von der Leyen went public on the record for the first time on We Need a Commissioner defense. For Defense, which is an interesting concept for many. Having said this, I tend to be with Mark on the absence of some, on the absence of some strong voices in that debate. Not everybody needs to be there every time, obviously, but still, it would have been good. You know, I would have loved to see the French and German security arrangements with Ukraine to be signed jointly in the same in Munich, rather than having two separate trips and the poor Zelensky having to tour Europe to get his security agreement.
Especially because half of this conference is about Europeans stepping up, doing more, the need to do more collectively, and the total lack of a clue how to get there.
I think, Jana, you are too harsh on that. I mean, let's look at what's been done rather than what's been on the show. And, you know, when you look at what is being done, I would suggest that the glass is half full. Of course, you can tell me that the other half still needs to be filled, and I probably would agree with you. But I mean, these are very testing times for the European Union. I think the fact that Europe can manage to kind of walk together in unity is almost a miracle.
I think that I have to say I was kind of struck by how both there were a lot of women making the case for it, looking, but it was a very different debate. And I think even the Americans were kind of had a sense that Europeans are stepping up, and there was a lot less complaints
about
Europeans.
That was the strong message to us, I think. That was the strongest message from the Americans. Please do step up.
But also an acknowledgement that Europe is stepping up. But
yeah, that's true.
One of the Europeans who was there, Jana, was your Chancellor. Olaf Scholz, who gave a speech in German and then answered some quite tough questions in English. What did you make of his performance?
So the first thing that I found remarkable is that he dedicated his entire speech to Ukraine and basically the situation with Russia, European security. And I was wondering, if you are an African participant sitting in the audience or from Brazil or South Africa, if there was something in that speech for you. And I was wondering, because the chancellor has put a lot of energy into building these relationships, and last year he was here making the case that this is not a war, basically, that is between Russia and the West, but this affects everybody. This has a global implication, and he was not making any such references this time, which I thought it was a rather Eurocentric speech. Maybe he made this conscious decision because he now understands that it's really up to the Europeans to do more. And he was making the case also for more support for Ukraine in Europe. I think calling upon the other European countries, all those that didn't have a head of state and government present, to pay more for Ukraine, and always putting Germany as a positive example, highlighting very often, very much, that Germany is the second largest donor to Ukraine, supporter, and that other European countries need to step up as well.
Just one more sentence on that. I think he made a pretty compelling case for fighting war fatigue. You know, this is affordable, this is sustainable. We need to do it. We had the right decisions in the EU when it comes to financial support and the package of assistance. We are stepping up as Germany on military assistance, and that's quite significant, creating a benchmark for others to, you know, try to catch up, or at least don't look too bad. And I think that was interesting.
So I think maybe his intention, last point, was really also to signal to the American delegation, look, we are really doing more, and we have the Zeitenwende, and it's not perfect, but we are in a good way, and we have understood the message. I think that was, so it was not a message to the basically global south or to the entire world, but very much also...
Let's face it, 2024 is the election year in Europe also, and it's election year in the US. And I think just like Kamala Harris was talking to the American citizen in Ohio, I had the impression that Chancellor Scholz was speaking to the citizen in Würzburg. And that in the meantime, and doing a rationalization of why it's important to continue to support Ukraine. And that's important. We've got elections coming up soon. But he was also talking to the American delegation.
Yes, I think so.
So it was interesting, like compared to Davos, where there was a lot of Gaza and other topics, there was much less Middle East and Gaza. I mean, there are a lot of people from the Middle East here, but this is much more of a Ukraine conversation that we've been having. And I think one of the reasons for that is because Donald Trump set the tone for this conference rather dramatically with his recent interventions on the future of NATO and the advice that he been giving to Putin about what to do with countries that are not spending enough. This idea of preparing for Trump is a big ECFR theme. Jeremy Shapiro and Maida have done various reports on the different Republican tribes, and we're going to carry on doing that, looking at different scenarios. Jeremy and Jana produced a report last year on the vassalization of Europe. But also, there's a very important article in the current issue of Foreign Affairs written by an all-star cast of ECFR council members, of which Arantxa
and
colleagues as well, of which Arantxa and Femi are co-authors on Trump-proofing Europe. Why don't we talk a bit about that? Arantxa, do you want to lay out the kind of framework that you set out in Foreign Affairs, and we can maybe go a bit deeper on the defense stuff with you, Kemi?
No, I mean, look, for Europeans, this is a moment of truth. We in Europe knew that with a more hostile international environment, with the brutalization of international affairs, our model required a bit of an adjustment. I mean, ours is not a war project. Ours is a peace project. But today, in order to be able to sustain this peace project, Europe needs to harden itself, needs to give itself the teeth and the tools to survive in this more hostile environment. Now, this predates the current 2024 election in the U.S., let's say that we had a fair share during the presidency of Donald Trump. We've had a reminder with Russia invading Ukraine. And now we are maybe contemplating the possibility of a return of Trump to the White House. So Trump is the accelerator. Trump is also going to make it more difficult for us what we have to do, the only avenue we have ahead of us, which is more European integration, solidifying the European family on the economy, solidifying the European family on securing defense. Difficult because it was one where we have still a strong nationalistic view of security and defense, and especially protecting the European democracy. This, again, predates Donald Trump, but takes a new meaning with the possibility that Donald Trump may come back to the White House, which is why we now, instead of talking about Donald Trump, and on this, I think, let the American voter make their choice. Let's respect that choice, like good democracies do, but let's focus on what we can do. Let's focus on what we can change, which is taking measures to further integrate the European Union in those key areas.
So, Kemi, you are also an author of this piece. What are the ideas that you want to share with our listeners?
No, it was a very interesting exercise to do this also jointly with a number of colleagues, because we all came in with our perspectives and experience. The key argument is really face the truth in general and act, you know, rather than just panic or pretend it's not going to happen. And when it comes to defense, I would very much agree with Arantxa's point. We have a situation where it's an accelerator. It's not, you know, it's to do things that we have to do anyways, but to do them potentially faster and with maybe a slightly different focus. So first, and that's happening now because of Congress, we need to put our act together when it comes to assistance to Ukraine as Europeans. And we have to decide how much we can step up to be on top of this. And this is doable, but it requires really a sustained and very deliberate effort. Second, we have an effort to rebuild our military. We have to do it because of the 2% target. Good news, 2/3 of allies are on that. Bad news, that's coming late and there is a lot of work to do, and that will require a sustained effort to rebuild our military and rebuild some mass to create a deterrence and defense that is appropriate to the current environment. Thirdly, we need to fill the gaps where we have the most important dependencies on the Americans. You know, they are, you know, when it comes to tanks and planes, most of the tanks and planes in Europe are European. But if you start looking at what are the strategic elements that enable the operations of NATO as a coalition or any coalition, it's often the Americans that provide the critical tools, space, intelligence, drones, strategic airlift, you name it. So this is where the Europeans need to make a very deliberate effort to not be in a situation where they have dependencies, and they have to be able to do this. And lastly, there is a tricky element, which is, of course, the nuclear deterrence element, which is extraordinarily difficult to replace, and that shouldn't be the intent. But how do we start thinking through this and having a conversation about what is the role of the Europeans in this, and what is a honest conversation on that, both with the Americans, but also amongst Europeans, both nuclear and non-nuclear? All this is a complex agenda. It has some institutional implications. More EU versus a more European NATO versus the duties of each member state. But altogether, I think it is all of this is doable, but it requires to act. And by the way, even if Trump is not elected, it's going to be useful. It's not a waste of money.
So that's one of my takeaways. I had dinner with a small group of leaders last night, and there was a European prime minister who said, just shut up about Trump and talk to people about why they need this stuff anyway, so that it doesn't sound like we're doing this for Trump, we're doing this for us. And that does seem to be the sentiment from some of the European leaders on the panel as well. Mark Rutte, I think, was saying similar things, and the Norwegian Prime Minister, Jonas Gahr Støre. Jana, one of the really interesting things when we look at this agenda is particularly in Germany, there's a fear that if we develop the sort of capabilities that Kemi is talking about, they will create a self-fulfilling prophecy. This is one of the favorite German ways of framing these things, and allow the Americans to pull out. And therefore, the best way to keep the Americans in is to infantilize ourselves and not have the capabilities, because then the Americans will need to help Europe, because it is, after all, too big to fail. To what extent has that kind of thought process been changed with the Zeitenwender?
So not through the Zeitenwender, because if you look at the Zeitenwender, it's very much oriented towards working with the Americans and making ourselves dependent on America. If you look at our shopping list when it comes to things that we want to procure, it's heavy with American products, the F-35, the heavy transport helicopters, and others. So I think the Zeitenwende as such lacks a European angle. I think Camille agrees with me on this. But I think now there is this sense of urgency, and people realize that Trump is a real possibility, and that we cannot rely on the United States. But it's a process. And what I think, Arantxa, you said that the EU is more federalized and that we are on a good path. I think what I witnessed in Germany is that when it comes to security and defense, there is a reluctance to see the EU as the forum for action. It's about the European pillar of NATO, but Germany is very much behind that idea. But I think the German mode of thinking is that if the worst case comes true and Trump gets elected, we need to make sure that NATO functions without the United States, or with a dormant America, but we need to keep the structures of NATO, and we need to, and that is basically a strategy that if the Democrats win and Trump is not reelected, then it makes us a better ally, makes the alliance more stable, and encourages the Americans to stay engaged. But so it's a hedging strategy and an engaging strategy at the same time. It's basically what Jeremy and I advocated in our vassalization piece.
So let me say that, I mean, I fully agree with Jana when she says that we need to Europeanize NATO. This is the way to go. But there is another dimension of this discussion that is an internal market discussion. Mm-hmm. We've got a defense industry that today is too fragmented to represent an alternative to the appetizing catalog that comes from U.S. Defense companies. So we do have their responsibility to do a bit of work to make sure the defense industry becomes, the internal market as regards the defense industry becomes stronger. And this is, interestingly enough, a big part of my conversations at the Munich Security Conference have been with defense industry companies that themselves are kind of scratching their head to understand how this can be done and who's going to initiate this conversation, because they really think now the time has come to do it.
Just one more word on that NATO versus EU conversation. Number one, interestingly, Macron, since his speech at Bratislava, has been using the European pillar of NATO word, which is a very German expression. So that's, they are maybe closer than they think. Second, on the role of the EU, it is absolutely clear that the EU has a critical role to play in this moment. Next to what the nations do and next to what NATO has to adjust itself, the EU is becoming a real player when it comes to defense industry and technology. It's a very important player when it comes to military mobility intra-EU. All of this is a lot of money. The idea of moving from a few billions to a double-digit commitment on the EU budget in the next cycle is really interesting. And the Commissioner for Defense, which is in fact more a Commissioner for Defense Industry than for Defense, is going to be, I believe, an important...
They won't have their finger on a EU nuclear...
But still, Camille, you need to have the buy-in of the member states. And here, looking at Germany, and I've just... Sorry for the kind of self-advertisement here, but I've written a piece on this for another institution, where I basically map the German thinking on this. And there is a lot of skepticism vis-a-vis the EU initiatives, the acronym SOOPs. There is not really the conviction that this will kind of catapult us into the future and make us resilient and capable.
I agree. I think the German debate, the way I would characterize it, is it's a bit of going in all directions on that. There is a strong group that does believe that NATO is where you do defense. And will remain primarily around the Ministry of Defense. And then sometimes you have rather interesting comments on we need an EU deterrent, which are
detached from reality,
which are indeed very detached from reality. So you need now to bring those conversations into a place where Germany recognizes that the EU has to play a role in this, while recognizing that this is not about an EU deterrent.
Well, let me just make a more general point. I think we have not had a serious discussion with the European citizen, neither in Germany nor in other member states. We need, if this is to be a priority for the European Union, we need to put this also at the national debate so that the citizens embrace this initiative. The latest poll tells us that, over 80% of the European citizens think that we should have an European common defense policy.
Yeah, but they have done throughout my whole life.
Let's unpack now with the citizen what this.
But the problem is about money and how to distribute it. It's about do you want to buy tanks or do you want to invest the money in, I don't know, social welfare? And we have this discussion acutely in Germany right now because we have this verdict.
We're going to have a whole separate episode, I think, on the Schuldenbremse and the and on the Supreme Court.
Because I always wonder if the Europeans are so on board with doing defense collectively and spending a hell lot of money, if that means that the money is not spent on other areas. So I think we need to have a debate about debt.
We do, but this is the world in 30 minutes. So we're going to have to, unfortunately, round off what's been a fascinating discussion. We have one thing left to do, however, on this podcast before we end, and that's our bookshelf segment.
So I read again Susan Glasner and Peter Baker, The Divider, to prepare and to just remember how it was.
What's on your bookshelf, Kemi?
You asked that question not so long ago, so I'm still reading the book from the Sylvie Kaufmann, The Blinded, which really starts with the Munich speech by Putin in 2007.
And what about you, Arantxa?
I'm reading a very interesting book about a new type of war, the cognitive war. It's called Foolproof, Sander van der Linden. Very recommendable for that part of the conflict too.
And I would recommend the article on how to Trump-proof Europe, which Kemi and Arantxa are co-authors of. This brings us to the end of these discussions. We'll put links up to all the publications we mentioned on our website at ecfr.eu and in the show notes. If you've enjoyed listening to us, please do head to whatever platform you use to listen to this podcast on and subscribe to future episodes. And while you're there, it would be wonderful if you could give us a positive review and a 5-star rating. But for now, from Arantxa Gonzalez, Yana Pouliérine, Camille Grand, and myself, Mark Leonard, it's goodbye. The researcher of this podcast is Anand Sundar, and our editor is Mireya Farrow-Saran.